This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. To create your own space, visit squarespace.com and save 10% by using offer code TREK8. And also by TrekFan. It's not just a fan club, it's an adventure. You'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. Don't miss out. Help move us toward the Star Trek future by visiting TrekFan.org. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit Trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 108, Jonathan Archer and the Temple of Doom. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Michael Fisher. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including an interview with 1/8 Beverly, the new fan favorites digital collection, where fans watch their episodes, and a recap of Star Trek Las Vegas. Then in the feature, we're joined by James Morehouse and Colin Higgins to discuss the Enterprise episode, Kir Shara. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, Michael. It is wonderful to have you co-hosting The Ready Room with me for the very first time. How are you doing this week?
I feel great right now. I've been just tickled pink to be offered a chance to co-host the news with you, Chris. So very happy to be here. I've had a wonderful day that started with me at an MIT swap meet looking at 30-year-old computer parts that I could have bought for very little money, but I didn't. But it was fun to be surrounded by technology so early in the morning, and it's nice to be closing out my day talking about Star Trek with you.
Were you actually looking for some sort of vintage Star Trek themed technology there that you could bring home at a bargain price?
No, you know, I mean, I wasn't, but there was plenty of it. There was plenty of it that could have served as set dressing on any of the original series episodes where they went back to 1930s. America. And I probably could have loaded up on vacuum tubes enough to fill a pickup truck with, but I restrained myself.
I always remember your story of how you obtained that. Is it a Nokia phone, the communicator?
Yes, prototype, indeed. As a matter of fact, I never let it far from my sight, Chris. It's right here next to me in the booth.
Oh, yes, it's right there.
Yeah. Yeah, the Nokia communicator. Gosh. Yes, one of only 12 in the universe. Definitely check that video out. Listeners, you should search for Star Trek Nokia communicator cell phone. Chris, one of these days you and I will meet in person, and I will give you some hands-on time with this device.
Excellent. I can make a call to the future.
That's exactly right. And the past at the same time, because it's based on a really old design, but yes.
Well, you know, maybe that place where we can meet up and make that call will be Star Trek Las Vegas, maybe next year. But unfortunately, neither of us were able to be there this year, but I thought it would be nice to recap a few of the key happenings from the con here this week, for those who went to remember them and for those who couldn't go, just to, you know, find out what actually happened there.
So, yeah, this was my question, Chris. I mean, I know we did have a presence, a Trek FM presence at Las Vegas this week. We had Charlene Schmidt was in attendance. I just listened to her pre-convention show yesterday, I think. So I got all caught up in what she was planning to doing, and then I followed her live tweets from the convention floor, and with each one, I grew more envious because it really seemed like a heck of a time.
Yeah, it was great. We had four people there actually from Trek FM. Of course, Char, as you just mentioned, Lori Sears from To the Journey, and then Mike and Max from Commentary Trek Stars. And they were all tweeting from the Trek FM account the whole time. So I hope that everyone who follows us on Twitter did enjoy. I certainly enjoyed sitting here in Tokyo and reading the narration of what was happening up on the stage. comments the actors were making at all. It was really wonderful.
It really was. I sometimes forget how big the Trek FM family has become, and I never forget, though, how remedial my Twitter following skills are, so I'm sorry I didn't mention the other members of the team there. I had no idea four people were there from Trek FM. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And, you know, Chris, I seem to recall you and I saying something like this last year or the one before. I think it must have been 2012 when I was like, yeah, I'd like to meet you, Chris. Maybe we'll do it at Las Vegas this year. And this is now the second time that hasn't happened. So let's try for 2014, shall we?
Let's try to get there. It's such a big trip from Tokyo. It's very expensive, and
things didn't quite work out this year,
but definitely next year. I've got so many people telling me you've got to be there next year, or I'm going to come and move into your house and carry you away or something. So to come to Star Trek Las Vegas.
I had the you know, excuse in my pocket all the time. Was like, listen, no, I'm going to the Boston convention this year. I'll get my yearly convention in. And you know what? This year I gotta say it was nowhere near what I saw from Vegas. I mean, I knew the Boston Con was going to be small, but this year's was smaller than most Star Trek conventions I've been to. So I think it's time. It's time to hit the big time. It's time to stop messing around. You know, we're adults now. We got to go to the real Trek convention. So let's make a pact. Let's exchange virtual blood and an Indian handshake.
Excellent. So as far as this year goes, a few things. I pulled out a couple of items from each day that I just thought we could talk about because they're things that interest me. And then I know you've also reviewed what happened, so you might have some things to throw out there as well. The first one was that Anthony Montgomery and Connor Trenier were up on the stage. And they said that they would both love to return to Enterprise should Netflix decide to produce a fifth season. And of course, today in the future, we're going to be talking about the Vulcan Serenite trilogy from Enterprise. And I mean, of course, they're at the biggest Star Trek convention in the world. Of course, they're going to say we'd love to come back. But, you know, I actually think that they mean it. I think that they would like to come back.
Yeah, you know, one of the greatest things, and this is a question, one of the first questions I would ask anyone who was ever on any Star Trek is, isn't one of the greatest things about working on a weekly television show that, assuming you like the people you work with, which it was the case on most of the Star Trek series, isn't it wonderful? Because as an actor, you're leading this gypsy lifestyle most of the time where you have a new cast. If you're doing theater, you have a new cast every 8 weeks. If you're doing a movie, you know, you have a new group of co-stars every few months. If you're lucky. But, you know, if you're on a TV show that runs for 4 years or 7 years, you get to you form this second family. And it's got to be wonderful. I have no trouble believing that both Anthony Montgomery and Connor Trenier mean it 100% when they say they would do it again. And not just for the work, you know, as the cynical viewpoint holds. And wouldn't it be great to see them again on screen in Starfleet uniforms?
It would. Yeah, most definitely. How do you feel about this? We've talked about this on the show a few times. How do you feel about a fifth season of Enterprise on Netflix?
You know, I feel about it the same way that I feel about like Santa Claus, where it's like, yeah, that's a really nice idea. I really wish that could happen. You know, it's not. Yeah. I have no faith in its possible. You know, I think it's cool to think about, but I think that the Star Trek universe is going in a very different direction. I mean, obviously, you'd like to see.
Yeah.
It.
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm starting to warm up to the idea a little bit. My initial reaction to it was that I'm really not interested, and it's not because I don't love Enterprise. It's just that I feel like the show had its run, unfortunately it was canceled early, but you know, we're 10 years removed now from, you know, more than 10 years from when the show launched. We're getting close to 10 years from when it left the air. And I don't know, I feel like it's time just to move on. And they've played the Romulan War out in the books. They're now bridging the gap to the founding of the Federation in the books. And all that stuff is, you know, sufficiently licensed and sanctioned by CBS. So I don't know. I will say that we started watching Orange is the New Black on Netflix, and I was really impressed with the production of that show. And this is something that I never would have imagined saying a year ago, but I actually think that Netflix is perfectly capable of producing Enterprise in a fifth season and making it a fantastic show and making it polished and everything that we expect it to be. But yeah, I just kind of don't think it's actually going to happen. I think there's too many players involved, you know, with the licensing and then everyone's schedules. Even if they say they want to come back, you know, they do have careers going otherwise. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. You know, and the audience has changed too. You know, I think back when, when UPN was in charge, obviously there was some, they couldn't really necessarily get a proper feel for the audience. And, now with two films between here and there, actually more than that, but two much more significant films in the new J.J. Abrams universe, you know, the whole conversation around Star Trek has changed. And so I think that militates against going back to the world that Enterprise inhabited. And Chris, I think you're right. I think it's definitely time to move on. But I got to say, I would watch Star Trek in any incarnation if it came back to TV on a weekly basis, because I think pretty much everyone can agree that's something that we would really, really benefit from as fans, right? Waiting for a new movie to come along every 3 years is just, oh, agony, isn't it?
What if that incarnation were actually about a crew of crossdressers and it was loosely based on Bosom Buddies?
You know, I'd still watch it. I would, and I would have a good time. I would dance along with the theme song at the very least.
Me too. All right. Well, another thing that happened on the first day was a view of the restoration of the Enterprise D bridge, which, of course, I'm sure you're quite familiar with this project that's been going on, and they're turning it into a traveling museum. And it was, I'm sure, very nice for everyone there to actually be able to be there and sit down on that bridge and just see a great piece of Star Trek history, you know, knowing that TNG is really responsible for the explosion of the franchise as we know it now.
Yeah, no, Chris, I have a question for you. Do you know specifically what elements of this bridge are reconstructed and which are restored? Because as I understand it, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to find the answer to this before coming in the air. As I understand it, only the tactical horseshoe was preserved and the rest of it was scrapped when Generations was over. But am I wrong on that or what?
I don't know for sure. I think my feeling from what I've heard is that there's more than just the horseshoe. But again, I don't know for sure, so I'd have to look that up. We'll put some links in the show notes to more information about this. And there's been a lot of stuff documented, the process documented and all. So the information's there. We go in and dig it up. It's been a while since I actually got into the details of this, so I don't remember exactly.
Yeah,
I just
took a gander. Yeah, it looks like the original set was destroyed for Generations, but this is a duplicate set created in 97 by Paramount under the supervision of Herman Zimmerman and Michael Okuda. So this is about as authentic as you're going to get. Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
That sounds about right.
But I don't know if we've talked about this on the air before or if I wasn't here or what, but that horseshoe rail, when the original bridge was created in, you know, 1987, was sculpted by, I was reading about the process of how it was built recently, and it was, I'll throw a link your way that we can include it. It was put together by a very, very talented man who I think just very shortly after completing it died in a motorcycle accident. So the bridge of the Enterprise has this kind of, you know, it's a sad story, but it's wonderful to see that preserved, even if it's not the original, just to see the spirit of that craftsmanship kind of live on in this recreation, which a lot of people got photographed with in Las Vegas, and it looked really, really impressive, even in its half complete state, didn't it?
Yeah, it really, really did. Yeah. So that's an interesting story. I wasn't aware of that. So on the second day, John Delancey was on stage and he was talking about some of his recent projects. And one thing he said really caught my attention because of the last Ready Room, where we had Mike Rittenhouse and Darren Moser on, and we found out that they are a couple of bronies or My Little Pony fans. And John Delancey says that he's been working on a documentary about bronies.
Yeah. Now, Michael, are you? Do you like the My Little Ponies?
Well, my very close friend has worked closely with some of the people behind the resurrection of the My Little Pony franchise, and so I have been tertiarily connected with that world, and I have no choice but to like bronies. You know, here's the thing. I will never have a problem with a group of people banding together to like something weird that not a lot of, you know, that quote unquote normal people don't necessarily like in huge numbers, because, you know what, I caught so much S for that in elementary school and in junior high because of Star Trek. So, man, if you're a brony, be a brony. I think that's cool. I also think it's ripe territory for a documentary, though. I think this will, I wasn't at the convention, but I can only imagine that the thing going through most people's minds as they heard John Delancey say this was like Trekkies. I mean, it sounds like a documentary just like Trekkies, except with bronies as the subject matter, doesn't it?
It does. It does. See, for I have not seen any of the new My Little Pony stuff or the comics. You know, IDW does a comic series as well. Right. So when I think of My Little Pony, I just think of when I was a kid and when my sister was little and the figures, you know, in the stores and all. But Darren was telling me about the Powerpuff Girl, My Little Pony connection in terms of the writing. And I love the Powerpuff Girls. So right. I might have to check this out and see what it's like. So, and then I can watch John Delancey's documentary. And Walter Koenig told fans that the older I get, the more I appreciate Star Trek in all its forms. And this just struck me because I think it pretty much sums me up. That's how I feel. I've always loved Star Trek since I was a little kid, but I certainly appreciate it much, much more with each passing year.
Yeah. And it's so interesting to see Walter Koenig say that, because I think he's kind of been the most private of any of the original series cast, right? You know, he's kind of been the most not outspoken, you know, the most reserved. And that's nice. I think that maybe a lot of people thought that meant he didn't like the franchise for a long time or something. I don't know. He's a mystery to me. He's fallen through the cracks on a lot of my original series research and stuff. And I'm about to read the book Inside Star Trek. It was long out of print and apparently a really wonderful piece of source material for anybody looking to understand the original series work environment. So hopefully I'll have some more insights there. But it's so nice to see any of the original series cast say that they appreciate the show more as time goes on and not less. That's wonderful.
Yeah, most definitely. So on the next day, this was the big event. Everyone was, they were pumping it up before the con. We've got to get that costume record back to American soil, because 2011 Star Trek Las Vegas, they set the record with 1,041 costumes. And then Destination Star Trek London broke the record with 1,063. And finally, they set a new record this year.
They did. They broke the record by 22, it looks like. There was 1,085 fans in costume in the same room. That was it, right? That was the Guinness qualification. They had to be in the same room. Yeah. So I think that's awesome. I think it's pretty awesome that Terry Farrell was one to help break that record by wearing a red TOS dress t-shirt.
Yeah.
It's pretty sweet.
So tell me, conspiracy theory here. Star Trek London broke the record by 22. Star Trek Las Vegas broke their record by 22. What's going on here?
I don't know. I was watching those numbers, and for a second I misread them. I'm like, oh man, wouldn't it be great to get 1701 people in the same 1701 people in a uniform in the same room? But I guess you'd have to get a much bigger room, wouldn't you?
I guess so. Yeah, I'm sure there's a fire hazard, something going on there.
Yeah, the fire marshal probably would have something to say about that.
Do it outside.
Yeah, do it in a big old tent outside. Yeah, no, this makes it even more.
Then the fire marshal walks in the room and people say, "That's not a Star Trek costume."
Yeah. What are you supposed to be? Some kind of waste extraction person?
I heard there was a Horta in here.
Well, you know, it's a shame because one of my favorite parts about conventions is wearing costumes. So to be part of this must have been quite a special moment. And we saw some wonderful photos of people in costume, and the photos beamed back to us. Were most or all of the Trek FM team wearing Trek threads on this one? I remember Charlene saying she didn't know if she'd have time to do any cosplay preparation.
You know, that's a good question. As far as I know, they were not wearing costumes. You know, I told Char she could just go as Samantha Wildman. I think that
that's
I think
right.
She looks enough like Samantha that she could
she
pull that off,
like her,
you know.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, I think they were all just dressed as Star Trek podcasters.
You know, and that's a sharp looking outfit, so I don't blame it.
You mentioned that Terry Farrell helped to break the record, and she had some interesting things to say about DS9. You know, Terry hasn't done as many conventions as a lot of the other actors have, and she talked about what she called her rocky relationship with Ira Stephen Baer and Rick Berman, and she said that she's been mending fences with Baer in recent years, but she still blames Berman for her leaving the show, which, you know, we always kind of wondered what happened. Of course, the first thing that happened was for some reason the studio signed the actors to 6-year contracts, knowing
yeah.
that the show was probably going to go 7 years, which was kind of weird. But it was interesting to hear her talk about that a little bit. And I also heard that she said that she gave them permission to use the clips of Jadzia in the montage in What You Leave Behind, but the channels got crossed and people didn't find out, didn't get the information that it had been approved or something and didn't get used. And that's something that I had not heard before.
Yeah, no, I hadn't heard that either. That's so sad. If that is the case that she gave permission and then it wasn't used. Cause that was one of those weird jarring moments of the DS9 finale where it's like, these flashbacks are lovely, but where's other Dax? I mean, where's the Dax that we lived with for 6 years?
Yeah, it was I mean, it still works for me because of all the other characters. But every time I see it, I feel like, you know, Jadzia really needs to be in here.
Yeah. I love hearing the stories about Terry Farrell behind the scenes. I mean, like, she's so funny to hear about at conventions. Because at more than one convention now that I've been to, I've, you know, heard from either castmates, you know, on the panels or people working the creation con or behind the scenes people, just like Terry Farrell. Somebody was saying Terry Farrell used to back when DS9 was on the air, she was doing her first convention. She used to come to conventions like bleary eyed and hungover from the night before and just dropping F-bombs all over the place in the panels and just having a ball. And apparently not much has changed because I read that this is somewhat rare convention appearance for her. I don't think she does it a lot anymore, but she was just igniting the whole crowd with a lot of hilariously crass jokes and stuff like that. I would say that Terry Farrell probably gives Marina Sirtis a run for her money as a convention guest in terms of just, you know, bombastic energy. You know, I would really like to see her.
Interesting. Yeah, me too. That would be a blast. I just imagine the audience reaction. Everyone's the organizers are probably like, oh my God, what did she just say? And the audience is probably eating it up. Like, that's awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love her comments about playing Dax too seem fascinating on this Trek News story here. And I think I caught some of the live tweets where she talked about playing Jadzia Dax and talking about, I wanted to be the female Indiana Jones. I wanted to be Lara Croft. You know,
oh, yeah. Lara Croft,
yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting insight into how she approached Dax.
Definitely. So then on the fourth day, she, along with the other castmates from DS9, all got together for a big reunion as we mark the 20th anniversary of the premiere of DS9. And that is really hard for me to believe, Michael. I don't know. I think I've asked you before what you were doing when DS9 premiered. I remember the premiere very clearly. I was in university at the time, and I remember the whole build-up, the development of the series, the premiere, people all over Birmingham going to pubs to watch the premiere.
What?
Of,
really?
The show coming on, and yeah, it was a big thing. You know, it had the biggest ratings ever for a syndicated show premiering at the time. It was quite an event.
Wow, people watching the DS9 premiere at pubs. That's amazing to me. No, I mean, were you one of them? Did you watch them out, or did you stay at home to take?
No, it? I watched it. I watched it at home. But yeah.
Well, I watched it at home too, but I was not of pub going age. I believe I was quite a bit younger, and I was watching it with my family, and I remember getting, I was probably like 9 or 10, and I remember being a little choked up about Chief O'Brien's departure from the Enterprise D. Like, none of the other significant emotional moments of the episode hit me, but when Chief O'Brien's about to beam off and Picard rolls up and he's like, "This was your favorite transporter room," and O'Brien's like, "Yes, sir, number 3. I don't know why, but that just struck me. Like, guys, I'm choked up now. That was a wonderful little goodbye scene, I thought.
All this stuff is going on with Sisko and the prophets, and he's reliving the death of his wife and all that. And then Michael's getting choked up that Miles is leaving the Enterprise.
That's exactly right. It's exactly right. Well, you know, at least, you know, Miles O'Brien wasn't doing the Sisko surprised call of delight, or the hand clap of rage.
But at least you know that even though he was leaving the ship, his hair was staying behind, because there's that scene where he goes up onto the bridge and there's that female officer who has the same hairstyle as Miles O'Brien.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, and that was another sad moment. He goes up to the bridge and no one's on duty. Like, there's just a bunch of randos sitting in the chairs. And when I was watching the episode, I was like, "Why? Where is everyone?" You know, not realizing that there's a budget for this episode and they can't afford to pay every Next Generation cast member to show up for this thing. So it's like the night watch on the bridge. And I'm like, "Oh, this is really sad." So when Captain Picard showed up, I was like, "Yay, someone's there to say goodbye."
Everyone, they're all on the holodeck doing a Dixon Hill novel or something.
That's right. They're playing Parisi Squares. They're busy. They got stuff to do in their off time.
So I would have really, really, as a Niner, I would have loved to have been there to see that cast reunion, because I love the photo here too, the TrekNews.net has of the cast, because DS9 had such a huge cast. Yeah. You know, the extended cast were like regulars because they were all there on the show all the time. And to see them all on stage together is amazing.
No, it is. And this is something that if I had actually been thinking a little bit more clearly, I would have actually made it my business to go to this thing. Because you know that this is a once every few years thing that so many DS9 cast members get together to talk about the show. And you're right, this photo from Trek News is huge. They're all lined up. I mean, it looks like the ensemble from a Broadway musical. Just amazing. And with the amount of emotional attachment I have to Deep Space Nine itself, this, I imagine for the people assembled, this was quite an experience. And I hope that at some point in the future we get to see another Star Trek where that kind of extended ensemble attitude is brought, you know?
I hope so. I hope so. You know, we saw in Enterprise a little bit of the DS9 storytelling type, what method of storytelling appear in the series, not to the extent of DS9, but compared to other Star Trek series, it was more like that. So hopefully, and with the way television in general is these days, when we do get that new Star Trek series, hopefully in 2016, I'm hoping maybe it will have more of that flavor as well. So it looks like just a really, really fantastic time that everyone had there at the convention. And of course, we really appreciate Shar and Mike and Max and Lori for covering the con for us and representing Trek FM. And for everyone else who helped distribute things, I know Mission Log, Trek Radio, Larry Nemechek, I think the TNG show as well, all helped to distribute some of our materials and cards about our shows. So we really appreciate that as well. And hopefully, Michael, we will see each other there next year.
Hopefully. I certainly look forward to that.
So one other person that we didn't talk about right here, who I believe was at the convention, a very small person at the convention, was 1/8 Beverly. Michael, have you seen 1/8 Beverly? Because apparently she's everywhere these days.
She is everywhere these days, and I caught wind of 1/8 Beverly only after my opportunity to see her had passed. I saw Gates McFadden at the most recent Boston Creation Con, and She had 1/8 around, but I only discovered her after the convention was over, and I started following Gates McFadden on Twitter and I believe Instagram. I'm not sure. But it's pretty much the most awesome and most peculiar thing I would never have expected Gates McFadden to do. Do you want to explain who 1/8 is?
Well, so 1/8 Beverly, for those who don't know, who haven't seen the pictures, is an action figure. It's a Beverly Crusher action figure who spent, to hear it described, basically spent most of the last 20 years or so trapped inside a box. And Gates McFadden has let her out, given her her freedom. And now Gates takes this Dr. Crusher action figure around and poses her in various places, takes photos, posts them to Instagram, to the website of her theater company, which is Ensemble Studio Theater LA. And it's just kind of become a sensation. And I was looking through a lot of the photos, and to give you an idea, some of it is, planned, like, oh, this would make a funny picture. And some of it is spur of the moment. Like, she's walking down the street and there's some shop called Picard's, and there's this shot of, like, she stopped on the sidewalk and she's got 1/8 Beverly looking back at the sign. And then in the distance, you see the shop that says Picard's. It's hilarious. And it reminds me of what, I have this little bear brick of Kirk. It's Kirk Bear. And I carry Kirk Bear around with me. And I take photos of him in different situations and I post them to Instagram. But what's really funny here is that it's Gates McFadden with a Beverly Crusher action figure. The person, the action figure is this person, and this person is carrying it around doing this. It's hilarious.
It's awesome. I mean, I love that because, Gates McFadden is another one of those people involved in Star Trek who I was never quite sure about how she felt about the franchise. And, I think that's gone maybe back and forth a little bit over time, but she's been quite active in the convention scene. And I love the story about how 1/8 got put into the storage module in the first place. Apparently in this interview from StarTrek.com, she first, the Paramount licensing department sent her this figure. And when she showed it to her son said, "Oh, a mommy doll," and apparently that made Gates feel uncomfortable. So she put 1/8 back into the original box and ended up keeping her there for 25 years in a storage unit. So it's so fun to not only see that she's broken out the figure, which, by the way, Gates notes has decreased in value, not increased. And now 1/8 gets to have a lot of adventures. And it's that Picard story is a great one. There's also the time 1/8 went ziplining, which is a very, very funny photo. And it was 1/8 was all over Boston when she was up here. So very, very, very awesome thing for Gates McFadden to do. Gates McFadden, by the way, in person looks amazing. Still runs this theater company, is the artistic director of her own theater company. They just auctioned off a comm badge. And, it's just crazy how much she's still, all over the place. And she's I'm completely inaccurate in this probably, but she looks as busy as William Shatner is. The jet setting, always left and right, popping up everywhere, William Shatner. Gates McFadden is just a surprise and a half, and I look forward to actually meeting her at one of these conventions because this 1/8 thing is hilarious.
Well, one reason we're talking about 1/8 today is that StarTrek.com landed the elusive 1/8 interview this past week because they said they've been trying to get it for a long time. They begged, they pleaded, they just could not land this interview. And you'd think they'd be able to get an interview with 1/8 Beverly, but apparently 1/8 Beverly is she's playing hard to get. And they got the interview, and it's really funny. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, but a couple of excerpts from it. They asked 1/8 what allowed you to change, after spending all that time being trapped in the box. And she said, "My boss, Gates McFadden, I got to say she was my enabler." So now we know that Gates is an enabler.
Right. Yeah.
They also asked 1/8, why travel with Gates? And I think that's a fair question. I mean, just because you look like her but smaller doesn't necessarily mean that you have to travel around with her. And I liked what 1/8 had to say. First, she said, I think you should ask her. She's the big shot in our relationship. Whenever I try to go it alone, she's always there manipulating me in some way. And I'm just seeing a theme here. 1/8 says Gates is an enabler. She's manipulative.
Yeah, there's definitely a really interesting inside tale about the curious relationship between original and duplicate. It's definitely worth a solid read, I would say. And if you want to continue the, do we know, Chris, offhand what Gates' Twitter handle is?
Yeah, it's really simple, very easy to find. She's just at Gates_McFadden.
And I'm just, I started following her after this convention and to see not only the 1/8 interactions, but the interactions with of course, TNG co-stars and, of course, Brent Spiner, who's going to be starring in her theater company's next show, but also with fans. Gates McFadden appears to be the, not only the type not to leave responses to interns or PR firms, but also the type to actually engage pretty readily with fans. So I definitely recommend people give her a follow.
Yeah, yeah, give her a follow and she'll talk to you and you can follow the exploits of 1/8 because it's really funny stuff. And the last thing I'll say about it is that, you know how sometimes you have someone in your family who has trouble getting a job and so you give them a job, you know, because you own a company or something? That's what Gates has done here. They asked 1/8, you know, what kind of jobs have you been able to get? 1/8 said, I mean, very honest too. I really appreciate this about the figure. Sadly, no one will hire me as a doctor. So Gates has given 1/8 a job as an artistic director at her theater studio.
Giving person.
Very giving. All right. So let's move on to the next item here. And I put this in here, Michael, because I wanted to find out how you watch Star Trek personally. StarTrek.com ran a poll to ask fans where they watch Star Trek. How do they get their Star Trek fix? And it was interesting to me because I have all of Star Trek on DVD. And before that, I had all of Star Trek recorded on VHS. I had some original series episodes on VHS that were actually packaged. You know, I used to buy them in the bookstore in the 80s for $15 for an episode on VHS. And most of it was stuff that I had recorded off television over the years. And I had just, you know, made my own labels. So I had the episodes. Well, then DVDs came around and I bought everything on DVD. And now I'm buying Blu-rays. But at the same time, I have Netflix. And so sometimes when I want to watch an episode, I just pull it up on Netflix. So the way we watch Star Trek is really changing. How do you typically watch Star Trek?
Chris, your story is similar to mine. I used to record episodes on VHS in high school when I got that capability. And, you know, you had to make that choice between, well, do I want high quality or do I want five episodes in one VHS cassette, right? Yeah. And that was great. That was my first ability to rewatch episodes at my desire. And it was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to have, and, you know, without spending a bunch of money on the official boxed VHSs. But then, of course, I graduated to DVDs and I bought them like crazy, and I asked for them for Christmas from my relatives and things of that sort. And I got everything from the authentic ones to the counterfeit ones from South Korea and China. That's how I got most of my TNG and DS9. But, you know, then Netflix came along. And, you know, Chris, I never got into the Blu-ray thing. I by the time all of Star Trek basically was hosted on Netflix, I had been so through done with physical media, and the idea of popping a disc into a drive and like having to walk across a room to manually put one thing into another. No, you know, the fact that it's all hosted on Netflix now is just, I maintain my DVD collection for the look on the shelf and, you know, a little security blanket just in case Netflix ever drops it. But really I stream 100% of my Star Trek these days. And
That's interesting because that's what the voters in the poll said. 32% said that they watched Star Trek on Netflix. And it's kind of what I expected. And for me it's weird that So I have everything on DVD, as I mentioned, and but I rip all my DVDs into the computer, so I have digital files because we have Apple TV, and we like to have all of our movies and TV shows that we own on physical media accessible mm-hmm. through Apple TV. So I rarely actually take the DVDs out of the boxes. But sometimes, even though I have the stuff in iTunes, occasionally I'll go and actually get out a physical disc because I you know, there's something on the disc I want, or I just want to go through the menu or something. And then sometimes, even though I have it in iTunes, I'll pull it up on Netflix instead. And then you mentioned Blu-rays. Like, I get into the Blu-rays because of all the extras on them. And that's something that you don't get on Netflix.
I know. And you know, man, I meant to say that in my diatribe. I really, really wish that the special features were available outside of the Blu-rays. But of course, that's, you know, I understand why they do it from a business perspective. But I would love to see some of those extras.
So the rest of the poll, 32% watch on Netflix. That's number one. Number two, 29%. So pretty close, Blu-ray or DVD. 17% cable TV or satellite. And that number was actually higher than I was expecting, because that's the old model of where you just wait until Star Trek happens to come on TV and you watch whatever episode they happen to be showing. And, but, you know, it's been so long since I watched whatever episode was coming on, I can't even remember doing that anymore.
You know, it's funny, and you're absolutely right. But at the same time, I am so susceptible to it, because I remember about a year ago, I was supposed to be doing some work in the afternoon. It was like a regular old work day. But BBC America was running a Next Generation marathon. And I just – somebody told me about it on Twitter. I tuned into it. And, you know, I'm like – I'm watching this episode on TV that's hooked up to an Apple TV where I could watch it on Netflix anytime. I have the DVD 2 feet away from the TV. I have so many options for watching this episode, but it didn't matter. It was on now, and it was the one that TV had on, so I just sat there and watched it. And then I was like, oh, which one's coming on next? So I totally get that there are people who will still watch it on cable and satellite, because, you know, when it's on, it's really hard to walk away from, isn't it?
It is. It is, yeah. And I'm like that too, yeah. I mean, if it happens to be on and I flip through and find it, maybe I'll sit and watch it. But it was the way TV is changing so much these days, and Star Trek is so accessible now. I was a little surprised that that was 17%, but I can see that. The next one is 10%, which is other, and I don't really know what that means. Like, you peek through your window at your neighbor's TV with binoculars. Yeah. I'm not really sure.
There's got to be a solid like 2 or 3% in there who still have the Betamax tapes. Watch it that way.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Laserdisc.
Yeah, yes.
Also.
Yeah.
I had Star Trek VI on Laserdisc. And I loved when you get to the middle. I think it was right around Ruapinthe where you had to actually take the disc out and flip it over and then play the second side.
That's so awesome. I have fun trying to find in the DVD where they've chosen to do that, because, you know, they do it automatically in the DVD now, but there's still that like half second frame jump where you can tell when the machine switches sides or switches. It may not be sides, but it may be layers.
It's like switching layers. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it's always exciting to see where they've chosen to put that break.
Yeah. So 8% said free streaming on CBS.com or StarTrek.com. And this I found interesting as well, because when you look at, you know, they repackaged The Next Generation on DVD recently. They did streamlined packaging. They did new artwork and such. And of course, you have the Blu-ray sets coming out as well. And all the stuff is on Netflix. And you can go to StarTrek.com and you can watch any episode of Star Trek for free right there. And so from a business perspective, you think about, like, why do they do this? Because are they cannibalizing their own business? Will that discourage people from buying Star Trek DVDs if they can go watch it for free? But I think their poll results show that that's really not the case.
I guess that surprised me when I saw that 8%. I didn't even know you could watch Star Trek on CBS.com. I had no idea that that was the case. 8% though, you know, there's got to be some studio bean counting department that's looking at that 8% and saying, you know, imagine if we could monetize that. Like, why are we just giving this away? I wonder if it's a mind share thing. I wonder if it's to drive traffic to the website so people will buy merchandise, maybe? You know, maybe there's some long play at work there.
It could also be just to drum up interest in Star Trek, because people like us, we're not going to go to CBS.com, StarTrek.com, and watch these episodes because we already have them on DVD, or we have Netflix and we're just going to stream it there. But, you know, people who don't have the stuff on DVD, and maybe people who don't have Netflix and they're just curious, maybe they went and they saw the J.J. Abrams movies and now they want to see more Star Trek. Having it on StarTrek.com, where people can come over there and just watch it for free and sample it, could drive them to then go buy the DVDs or buy the Blu-rays. Or
that's a good point.
I would say go to Netflix. I don't know if CBS... Does CBS have any involvement in Netflix? I don't think so, right? That's a totally separate company. And I don't know if they're involved in Hulu or not.
Hulu is a joint venture of a couple different networks, right? I think Hulu was an NBC thing at first. I'm not really sure, yeah.
At first it was, yeah. But now it's a lot of different studios. See, in Japan, there's no Netflix based in Japan, but we have Hulu here, and the original series and Enterprise are both shown on Hulu here. The last item in the poll was 3% download from iTunes or Amazon. And this didn't surprise me at all, because I've never really had the inclination to buy Star Trek from iTunes, as opposed to buying it on physical media, because I know that if I buy the DVDs, I can then rip them into the computer and then put them in iTunes. Whereas for the same money or more, you would be downloading the seasons from iTunes in files that are kind of locked into your account.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's ways around all this. And I get why the percentage is so low, but I also get why it still exists, because I don't believe Netflix has all of the Star Trek feature films yet. It doesn't. It's still working on securing rights to a couple of them. So sometimes you want that fixed. And if you don't have the DVDs and you're just like, oh, I got to show you, have a new significant other or something like that, it's like, well, you haven't seen Star Trek VI? I got to show you Star Trek VI. You know, it's like you fire up iTunes. It's like, yes, I will pay $4.99 for this rental. I don't care. Just give it to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Rental on the movies makes some sense. So it was an interesting poll, though. And yeah, I was curious what your experience was as well. And it leads us into the last item that we'll talk about in news today, which is this new digital collection, speaking of iTunes and Amazon, that CBS is putting out, called the Star Trek Fan Favorites Collection, Volume 1. And it's a collection of 10 original series episodes. And they're packaged together in a group, kind of as if you were buying a season of television. And it's 10 episodes for $9.99.
It's a killer deal. I was not aware of this either. And I'm struck by the question, why didn't they just do this before? Because these are some top-notch episodes in here. Everything from Sitting on the Edge of Forever to Trouble with Tribbles, you know, those classics, to the under-celebrated ones like, you know, Doomsday Machine and Arena. There's good stuff in here. And I say under-celebrated, you know, not in the fan culture, but outside of, you know, I don't think a lot of people necessarily remember A Piece of the Action, for example. But there's some good stuff in here, isn't there?
Yeah, A Piece of the Action is a great example. We did that on the Ready Room here not too long ago. And it's an episode that, of course, I remembered the basic plot of the episode, and I've seen it, you know, dozens, countless times really over the years. But I had forgotten how good it was and how funny it was. And all the little details, you know, like Kirk making up the rules to Fizban as a way of escaping. Right. So it's a real gem. Yeah, it's great to be in there. You know, I think that this is a lot like the Star Trek Origins Blu-ray that's coming out. I think that this is all designed for people who saw the J.J. Abrams movies and they want to know more about Kirk, Spock, Star Trek, the original series. And this is just another entry point for the studio to get people into Star Trek and make it really cheap for them to watch some of the best episodes.
Yeah, I completely agree. And this is exactly what you want when you have people coming out of the theater who are new to Star Trek. They've just seen the J.J. Abrams thing and they're saying, wow, I'd like to see more of this now and I've never seen it. But you don't want them just running to Netflix or iTunes and just, you know, grabbing Spock's brain, for example, and using that as their measuring stick, right? So you want a specially curated collection. And this is, boy, this would be a great, especially for the price. This collection is amazing. Did you mention the price already? I'm sorry. I didn't notice.
Yeah, $9.99. Normally, and I checked to be sure, these are HD episodes that you'll be getting in the collection. And the normal price for HD episodes is $2.99 per episode. So you're basically getting this for one third of the normal price.
Yeah, and it's available on all those platforms. I mean, iTunes and Amazon, Vudu, Xbox. Like, that's pretty awesome. I think they're onto something. And I like that you mentioned, Chris, that this particular one is labeled Volume 1, so it seems that we can expect some more in the future.
Yeah, it does seem that way. The original story that I read about this on StarTrek.com, I don't think it mentioned Volume 1, but then if you go in iTunes and you look, it's labeled Volume 1, which does imply that this is going to be the first in a series. It's kind of like the fan collectives. Did you get any of those, Michael, the DVD sets that they did?
I had forgotten about them until just now, but I did see them on retail shelves. Yeah, those are some pretty good collections. You had the Borg ones and the Klingon ones.
Yeah, that's where they gave fans a theme, and they let fans vote on episodes, and then the winning episodes got put onto these DVD sets. So it's kind of like that for the digital age, which is a whole lot easier to do. You can throw these things together anytime. You know, you just make some cover art, and the episodes are already in these different sources anyway, so throw it together and put a price on it. The way these were selected is they were selected by fans, by voters on StarTrek.com, CBS.com, and the Star Trek Facebook page. Now, they did give you a pre-selected choice, a set of 30 episodes, and you had to vote based on those 30 episodes, which is probably why The Way to Eden is not on the list. You know, probably just wasn't in the 30. Same for Spock's brain. They probably just weren't in the 30, or else they would, of course, have been
right
there.
Or else they would have shot right to the top.
So we'll put links to this in the show notes if you want to hop over. Again, as Michael mentioned, iTunes, Amazon Instant Video, Vudu, Xbox. There are a lot of different ways for you to get your hands on these if you'd like to have them. All right, Michael, that's all we have in news today. But before we jump into our feature, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for this week's show, Squarespace. Now, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that combines hosting and content management to make it simple for you to create your own space online. That could be a blog, a website, a portfolio, an online store. In our case, it's Trek FM, because Trek FM is built on Squarespace as well. You know, I've been using Squarespace for 6 years, and I use it not only for Trek FM, but for my personal website, for my company website. I use it for client projects sometimes as well. I really, really love Squarespace. And apart from the fact that the tools are awesome, they're constantly improving the platform with new features and new designs and even better support. And they have really fantastic support. And these designs make it easy for you to put together a website in, you know, not weeks, not even days, but just hours. I mean, you can just hop on, you can have a website up and running in absolutely no time. And it starts at just $8 a month. And if you choose the annual plan, you will get a free domain name registration as well. So, Michael, I'm not sure how familiar you are with Squarespace personally. So here are 3 points that I always tell everyone that really highlight why I think it's the best platform out there.
Please.
The first is that it's design focused. And Squarespace really cares about design. And that's one thing that really sets them apart for me from other platforms, is that they have professionally designed templates that are extremely clean, and they allow your content to be the focus of your website. But at the same time, you're not limited by those templates. You can modify them very easily and make the site your own. And really, no two Squarespace sites look alike. And Michael, you know, social media is really the big thing these days. And now I know that you work at Pocket Now. You guys are putting out content all the time.
Every day.
How much time do you guys put into actually promoting this content through social media?
A whole lot. I mean, there's a lot of cross-linking to the various social networks. There's a whole lot of just work involved in getting the word out to every corner we can possibly get it out to.
There is, yeah. And it's, but you have to do it these days, right? I mean,
absolutely.
If you're not marketing in social media, there's really no point in putting content online. And Squarespace makes that really, really easy by integrating social media with connected accounts. So whether it's Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn or Pinterest or Instagram, Google+, it's all integrated. You can put your account name in. You can actually connect it. And it's not the simple little share buttons that you see on a lot of websites. You can actually push your content out. So let's say, you know, you put up a new post, a new article, a new product for sale. When you post that, your Squarespace site will actually push that content right out to Twitter for you and announce it to everyone automatically. And, you know, Facebook, if you have a brand page on Facebook, you can actually share a page from your website directly on Facebook. You can specify through the Facebook interface which page from your Squarespace site you want to share.
But, I mean, none of this is, you know, really any good unless you can also view it on a mobile site, right? So, I mean, what's the story on that?
It's interesting that you would be concerned about mobile sites.
Well,
Michael,
you know, I'm just playing to my stereotypes. Yes.
Captain Two Phones. As someone who spends their days researching, testing, and writing about smartphones. Yes, a responsive design, you know, is a huge thing these days. And it's very, very important. And every Squarespace website has its own unique mobile design. And it reflows based on the screen size and the screen orientation. So you don't have to worry about building a special website for mobile and one for the desktop. You just build your website. And it's going to look beautiful on the desktop. And it's going to look beautiful on an iPhone, an Android phone, you know, a tablet, an iPad, whatever. It reflows. And they do very interesting things, you know, with sidebars where they slide them up underneath and reformat that content for the screen size. So absolutely beautiful, responsive design that you get with Squarespace.
That's good. And it's not just, it's not all form. There's some function here as well. I understand that Squarespace recently added some e-commerce features to its platform. So if you want to set up shop and sell things, presumably you can just do so in a few minutes. And it's nice. I mean, you were in charge of giving us the feature rundown, and I appreciate that. And I'm thankful for your vocal prowess there. But, you know, they all come together. Is what I understand. They give you a whole bunch of power, all of these features to create a space online that is professional quality. And it doesn't require any coding knowledge, which is great because I don't have any of that. And it allows you to focus on what really matters, which is the content you're trying to push out. Now, if you are someone who loves to program and you want to have 100% control over every line of code, Squarespace has a really awesome developer mode as well, as I understand it. I'm not that guy, but it's nice to know that those people are supported for even more customization.
Definitely, yeah. Because some people think the templates and they think that all I'm going to do is just drag and drop, which you can do, and it's great, you know, if you don't have that programming skill. Mm-hmm. But you can control every single line of code as well if you go into developer mode. So it's a very, very powerful platform, whether you are a web development expert or, you know, just an average person who just wants to share your thoughts with the world.
Captain Amateur.
Captain Amateur. But you won't look like an amateur when you're using Squarespace.
That's right.
But don't take our word for that. Try it for yourself, free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. Just enter your name and email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be building your website. If you already use a platform like WordPress, you know, you can import that into Squarespace, see how it's going to look, and see firsthand how Squarespace tools give you everything you need to create an exceptional website. Then when you decide to sign up, and I know you're going to want to, you can use our offer code TREK8 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. So support our sponsor and support the Ready Room. Visit Squarespace, use offer code TREK8. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM and for your support of Squarespace. And that makes it possible for us to bring this programming to you every week.
Thank you.
Ask anyone on the street, whether they're a Star Trek fan or not, to name one race from Star Trek, and chances are they'll say Vulcan. But despite everyone knowing Spock, the Vulcans are one of the races from Star Trek, probably the best-known race about whom we really know very little about, and it was left to Enterprise to fill in the blanks, and it's something that the series did beautifully. Unfortunately, a majority of the fan base missed it because they had tuned the show out by that point. But today we're going to talk about the Serenite trilogy and specifically the conclusion, Kirshara. And to help us do that, we have joining us for the first time in a really long time, it's James Morehouse, Enterprise Extra, as everyone knows him on Twitter. Hey, James, how are you today?
I'm great. Good to be here. And I love talking about these episodes. They are my favorites.
Well, they're your favorites for a reason, I believe, right, James?
Yeah, not only because I had the good fortune of appearing as an extra in Awakening, but because they're awesome. The Vulcan trilogy, the introduction of T'Pau, the fact that I got to appear in those episodes rather than just a one-off standalone episode makes me smile every day.
Well, that is really cool. And, you know, I was watching it and I noticed that guy firing phasers or putting the ship on red alert. And I thought, that's a weird looking officer right there. That must be James.
That guy was born to play that part.
All right. And also joining us, it's very early in the morning over there, but it is the Supreme Commander of Trek FM Europe, from what I hear from Trek News and Views in Deck 8. Our friend Colin Higgins. Hey, Colin, thanks for staying up for us.
It's an honor and a privilege to be back on the Ready Room, so thanks for having me back on. So,
yeah.
Yes, it's 1:30 a.m. here. But, you know, when you're the Supreme Commander, you have to burn the midnight oil.
That's right. Or ignite the midnight petroleum, whichever you prefer.
Yeah.
Well, we're glad to have you back on, Colin. I wish we could have you on more often, but the time zones are so far apart, so thanks for staying up.
I think we're spending about 18 hours here from time zone to time zone. So,
I really think so. Okay, guys, well, I'm excited to talk about the Serenite trilogy here. I watched the whole thing, all three episodes, twice this weekend, which is a little bit overkill to prepare, I guess. But, you know, I like these episodes so much that once I start watching them, I can't help but watch all three, and then I have to go do it again because I really think some of the best Star Trek around. It's too bad that more people don't know this story, I think. So, Michael, why don't you kick us off with Kirshara? We're going to talk a little bit about The Forge and Awakening, but we're going to focus especially on Kirshara today.
So it's funny, Chris, that you mentioned that this is some of the best Star Trek around because and that not a lot of people saw it. I didn't see it in its initial run. And as a matter of fact, before I was told that I was going to be on for this episode, I had never seen it. And so watching...
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I watched this entire arc, this three-episode arc, The Forge, Awakening, and Kirshara, back-to-back about an hour ago. I just ingested them all in one lump sum. And, you know, it is one of those arcs that Enterprise undertook, and that which was epic and kind of world establishing, that I do wish I'd seen in its initial run, because maybe it would have... No, I take that back, because it just would have made me sad, because at that point we knew the show was ending anyway, so it would have been like, oh, yeah. Well darn. Yeah. It's a shame we won't be able to see more of this. I don't think it was certainly perfect. I think it also... there were some examples of why Enterprise didn't make it in here as well, but on balance, I really think this was... Quite a nice peek into how the Vulcans became the Vulcans we know them, because that's one of the big complaints we've had about Enterprise. We'll get into that in a second, but that was my experience watching the episode. Was that
well,
wow?
Well,
this is cool
because I didn't realize you hadn't seen them, because you do know Enterprise quite well, which is one reason you come on our Enterprise shows often. It's interesting that you hadn't seen these, because you'll be able to give that perspective of having just taking it in for the first time. Yeah. And whereas I know Colin and myself, and of course James, having actually been in the trilogy, have probably kind of dug into it for so many years that we don't see it, you know, with those fresh eyes anymore. So
I know what all the sand grinds are.
You know them all. Every one of them on Archer's hat.
The best costume piece ever. I still want one of those. We were talking about that on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
The NX-01 hat. My favorite Star Trek costume piece. I love that.
You should have said. Thought you had them at Star Trek London. I could have got
you. Oh, man. What? Jeez. I got to stay in touch with you guys better.
I'm gonna tweet out a picture of mine later today.
Sweet. So. All right. Good.
There's more in the world than just cell phones, Michael.
I know. I got to remind myself of that every now and then. And Star Trek ringtones on them. You're right.
That's right. So, James, what is your initial thought on the trilogy? Because, I mean, you're the only person I know who wasn't actually, putting the show together itself, who couldn't see the show in first run because you were actually on the set in Awakening. So what was that like?
It's interesting. That's a funny question because I'm a total spoiler phobic guy. I hate spoilers. So I was trying not to get, I'm trying to take it all in on my 2 days on the set and get as much as I can. But like I see Soval is in a couple of my scenes and mm-hmm. he's got all this damaged makeup on the side of his face. And I'm thinking, oh my God, how do you get hurt? I don't want to know. I got to see that. And there's a bunch of things like that I was, I had to try to avoid because I didn't want to be spoiled, but it was well worth it. And for me, these are my favorite episodes of Enterprise, and it's not just because, again, I had the good fortune of being in Awakening. I just think they hit on that. I mean, the Vulcan trilogy, the Vulcan storyline that so many people had an issue with at the beginning of Enterprise, which I never did. I thought made perfect sense and was gonna grow into the TOS Vulcans, and this answers all that. I mean, it really does. Anyone who had an issue with it at the beginning, Mike, sounds like that might be you.
No.
Then I mean, this one pays it off, and I just love, from a selfish standpoint, when I realize that I'm in the episode that was basically introducing T'Pau, who was such a legendary mm-hmm. character from my childhood in the 70s watching TOS. Yeah. Now that for me, that's what these episodes, that's what I think about every day.
That's very cool. So avoiding spoilers, was it a case where you were only given the scenes that you were in and had no access to the rest of the story, or
no,
did you just intentionally avoid it?
Yeah, they gave me the whole script, but I didn't read it until after the show's aired. So you knew a little bit what was going on because during a scene they would talk about, okay, this guy Velas, he's the one leading this issue, and Archer and T'Pol are lost in the forge. That's why they're not on the ship. So all that stuff I'm kind of hearing and processing, and I'm thinking, I don't want, okay, all right, that's gonna be the episode before this. And I had no idea until I got there I was going to be in part of a trilogy or not just a standalone episode. So I'm literally just piecing it all together as I'm on set that day that, oh, this is kind of a big deal. And even in the last scene, which the second AD was so cool, I'm in the very last shot of the to be continued shot where I'm standing behind Trip pushing some buttons. And they're saying that, okay, this is where we're going to have this big to be continued. We're going to Andoria. And at that point, I'm just thinking, man, this is a big episode. I'm pretty fired up. So
they cut the scene where Trip turns around and says, keep your shirt on, Jimmy.
So, of course, in my mind, I'm on the ship somewhere in Kirshara. I'm there. I got to be there somewhere. So
you must be. Yeah.
So I feel like I'm in all three of these episodes.
Maybe you're in the Jeffreys troop at Argyle.
That's right. It'd be Argyle's great-grandfather who lives in the Jeffreys tubes on the NX-01 and makes gin.
You guys, it's an Enterprise tradition.
Making some of that Tucker family moonshine down in the Jeffreys tubes, yeah.
That's it. That's good.
Perfect. Maybe you're helping Chef get trips to pan-fried catfish fry.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. So, Colin, I think at Trek FM, you probably do the most Enterprise coverage of any of us on Trek News and Views. So, tell us about this episode and trilogy and your take on it.
Well, personally, I love this particular episode because it's basically the beginning of the evolution of the Vulcans that we come to know in TOS and TNG and DS9. and it's from this that they stem from. It's also another episode where we see a Vulcan who has high emotions, and we find out why at the end, because you get the little twist at the end. But there's also, I mean, Sussman wrote Twilight as well, which is another excellent episode. But it's also got ramifications that you see in other episodes. I mean, when he opens the Kishara on the table, he also evokes when the Nemesis, when the Phalaron device opens.
Yeah.
You get that type of impression. We get to see T'Pau before she made the rock band. and that's always a nice touch. You know?
I was wondering who's going to bring
that. And it's...
Heart and soul, baby.
Yeah, well, it had to be made. They are British. So. But it's one of them episodes that you can go to TOS and there's references to in TOS where you can go to TNG and there's references that you can find in TNG to it. And, you know, even when you go into Voyager, there's echoes of Meld in this episode. It's one of them episodes that just flows through the whole of all the Star Trek incarnations. And, you know, the actual story, the birth of the Vulcans and everything. It's a pivotal moment in Star Trek canon.
That's how I feel.
Yeah, definitely.
And you're not biased at all.
Well, let's talk about the design and direction a little bit, because one thing that I noticed when I watched this, and they did a really good job too, because it's, you know, different directors for different parts of this, of maintaining the continuity, and it feels very much like a TOS episode. To me, just visually, elements of it has a TOS look and feel to it with sort of a modern sensibility, is I guess the best way I can describe it, because obviously it's, you know, more polished and all than TOS is, but it's still being on Vulcan, and even though we only really saw Vulcan, I guess, in Amok Time in the original series, but just still feels very TOS for me. What did you guys think about the design, art direction, and the camera work as well in here?
But the TOS angle picks up nicely, because there is scenes where it's basically the same thing but redressed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a TOS trope, you know, just move the camera around to this angle, mm-hmm. film it from the same thing.
Are you talking about like some of the cave corridors there and the
and some of the desert scenes, it's exactly the same bit of desert, they just move the camera around to the side. So
that shoestring shooting there.
Yeah, but the Planet Hell set, and again, I had the fortune to be able to walk through there during one of my breaks.
I'm just sitting here being envious.
It was so cool. So it was,
Done this and I've done that, and yeah.
No, it was 2 days. Yeah. I am living. I am just lucky, man, because I am a diehard Star Trek geek for 45 years. So. I'm taking it all in, and I was able to get over to stage 16, which was across from the bridge set, and the planet set. It's amazing. I mean, I know that it gets a lot of flack for kind of being the reuse and like Michael just said, shooting from a different angle, and they're walking through this tunnel, and they cut back, and they're walking the other way. But walking through that set, it was really, really impressive, and I love the way that some of the shots at the end where they are kind of coming out of the cave and looking over the city. With the orange backdrop.
Yeah,
they had a lot of attention to detail on that set as well, because I noticed in the opening shot of, and I'm sorry, this isn't this episode, but it's the Forge. The opening shot of the Forge, where there's one word in the whole teaser, but you just get to follow this the wandering Vulcan, and there's actually moisture dripping from the ceiling at points, which you don't really see in a lot of the other uses of that set. And that was nice. And the use of Live Flame and these kind of spider webs that are everywhere. I mean, I think they did a nice job dressing it. And no, I agree. I think the this is not one of the episodes that deserves the hell that it gets. My stupid pun that I didn't mean to make.
But all of this is another reason why I call this trilogy Jonathan Archer and the Temple of Doom.
Yes. No, it's true. It
works
every other shot. That's good. It's like Scott Bakula.
I missed that big bulb.
Especially with the torch and then the spider webs come back. Yes. And then, oh, it's the Kirshara. But if I don't pick it up just right, this giant boulder may roll over me.
Yeah. Then he had like the door combination stuff that he, you know, the knowledge that he gets from Surik with the right. spinning on the impressions on the door. And I thought, you know, a lot of that stuff read pretty nicely.
So what he really should have done in that bit then, he's had a golden idol and a bag of sand.
That's right.
Right.
And don't he's got to get it. The white yeah. right. And then the door opens.
And the door opens. And then it's coming down and he has to do a barrel roll to escape it. So he can get the Kirshara back to the high command.
Yeah. And before the big boulder comes down and seals him in.
Right.
Colin, you mentioned it a little bit, but and I know the Kirshara prop, it's a little clumsy. It doesn't necessarily look like it's 1,000 years old, maybe. I can't remember how old it's supposed to be.
1,800 years, right?
But
1,800 yeah, is the time
I think
of Sarai.
Like 2,000, right. Yeah. But it totally pays off at the end for me with the final effect when Archer turns it on and the Surak's writings are displayed all over the room.
Yeah.
I just love that. And it does have a connection with Nemesis and that Romulan Senate scene. Really like that payoff.
And plus it ties back to how it was set up with the Idic, you know, earlier on in the episode not early in this episode, in one of the previous ones where she puts it on the desk and it does that holographic thing. So I agree. Yeah. When that thing became a hologram generator from the past, I was really okay with it because it did a nice job of communicating the importance.
Yeah. It's like when Archer turns on the time.
Oh, yeah. And Daniel's time map, right?
Yeah. And he's standing the time map and it's whirling all around him. So the actual concept of that type of display would be familiar to Archer. And therefore, when you think the Vulcans are more advanced than humans, you can see them having that technology sooner. I mean, we've got it now. We can do holographic projections now.
Yeah.
With lasers and stuff that would be similar to that. So if you advance that with Vulcan technology, then yeah, that's perfectly believable that could do that 1800 years ago, while we were still scratching around in caves. So
Michael, you're the phone guy over at Pocket Now. You're always giving us the latest news on cell phone technology.
Right.
Is this feature going to be in the iPhone 6, or are we going to have to wait till the iPhone 6S for this?
You know, as far as suspended holograms, you know, it might be a few years out from that. But every time a manufacturer does try and do anything with 3G, it ends up being 3D rather. It ends up being kind of underwhelming, and then giving people a lot of headaches. So I think we might have some waiting to do on this. Yeah.
Okay. Does it give people headaches the same way as when someone puts their Katra in your head?
You know, I think they make the similar kind of faces. Yeah, yeah, they do the Scott Bakula championship eye roll. And yeah, it's pretty gross.
Does that mean you have to put an iPhone 6 to your head and go, my mind to your mind?
Yes. Yeah.
When you're talking to Siri.
Siri,
when
you're talking my to Siri. Mind to your mind. All right. Well, this is a good transition point, I guess, then, into talking about T'Pau and the Sirenites and the whole idea. I mean, these Sirenites are following what they call the true teachings of Surak. And of course, they believe in the Katra. And there's a lot of talk here between T'Pau and T'Pol. That's very hard to say quickly. and Archer as well, about whether or not they believe in the Katra in the first place. And of course, we know that, you know, T'Pol, she doesn't believe in time travel. She doesn't believe in eating with her hands. And she doesn't believe in Katras, so it's no surprise there that this would be something that she's just not on board with.
No. And it's also interesting that her mom is a Sirenite.
I didn't get the impression that her mom was always a Sirenite, though. Her mom kind of turned after the events where she, you know, got booted from her teaching position and all. She started to really question. And it's one thing that I like. We talked about T'Pol on Warp 5 last week, and one thing we talked about was how T'Pol over the course of the series, starts to question Vulcan beliefs and ideals more and more and more and more. And here we get it on the entire scale of the society, where we see this entire group of Vulcans who are really questioning the authority of the government and are questioning the, at that time, the, I guess, long-held beliefs of Vulcans. And then T'Pol's mother here is also, you know, moving that way.
Yeah. I wonder if her mom eats with her hands.
I wonder if her mom can cut a breadstick with just a fork and a knife.
Yeah.
Well, she had to learn it from somewhere.
That's right.
I tried to do that. It's really hard.
Well, T'Pol, you know, I don't know. It strikes me that I've never seen really an episode of Enterprise where T'Pol didn't have a problem with something. And I think, you know, she was written that way deliberately and used to good effect sometimes. But the fact that T'Pol's mother, who she doesn't have a good relationship anyway, should be constituted so differently mentally than her daughter so as to join this effectively this cult, you know, it was not a huge surprise to me, because we did want to see, we did need to see them fight some more, clearly. And I don't know. I don't know how you guys felt about, I don't know how to feel about their relationship.
You might T'Pol sound like a Bajoran.
Well, but without, you know, except way less compelling. I don't know. It's strange to me. I would like to know how you guys feel about T'Pol and her relationship with her mother, because when her mother, you know, passed, I was like,
T'Pol the whiny teenager.
Kind of,
you don't love me anymore.
Right.
No one understands me anymore. I had to go away and join Starfleet and be with humans before anyone paid attention to me.
Her mother seemed really like tolerant of all of her eccentricities and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I don't know. That whole arc kind of failed to engage me too much. So I just didn't know if I was alone in that.
Well, that would play into the IDIC, though. Because the infinite diversity bit.
Oh, sure.
So,
yeah.
So.
Some parental hypocrisy.
Yeah. You know. Yeah.
I think Michael makes a really good point about T'Pol in every episode always not being satisfied. There's always something. I hadn't really thought about that, but it's that is pretty accurate. But the way their relationship works, I think it's a standard mother-daughter relationship, and and I think they execute it pretty well. I mean, is it the most engaging part of the story arc? Probably not. But I think it works, and I love the continuity from the early season 4 episode Home, and some of the other stuff they've done with Koss, her husband,
right?
You know, ended up being the linchpin to getting him into the Vulcan Council. So I love that continuity that they build off.
That was very nice. I enjoyed seeing that as well. Yeah,
I think one thing T'Pol was satisfied with was with her relationship with Archer. I think that was a satisfying relationship to her. Out of all the relationships that she had, I mean, the mom's relationship was fractured. Her relationship with Trip was fractured because of the emotion involved.
That's a good point. I like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, was basically a convenience. So the one stable relationship that she had was Archer.
Yeah.
Yeah, her actions depict that. She's always by his side, and she'll question him, but she'll never... not follow them.
And taking that one step further, I think it's really cool that Enterprise almost never, I mean, seldom and really almost never strayed into the predictable romantic element of that. You had a touch on it in one or two episodes of the Archer T'Pol thing, but really there was never any indication that this was going to be seriously pursued as a thing. And I think that's cool when a TV show can resist the urge to immediately sexualize any male-female relationship or any relationship, regardless of gender.
Yeah. I agree.
They made a joke about it because you had the episodes where Phlox was teasing Archer about
right. Yeah. But that was the extent of it, you know? I mean, I like that it never went beyond that. That's pretty... I thought that was cool. Sometimes restraint is the better option, you know?
Well, I mean, in regard to T'Pol, too, and I know, Chris, you love the Katras. And I know you've said that the
sounds like a college football team.
Little overused plot device, which I think is, I don't have an issue with it. I love it, but I love the mind meld with T'Pau and T'Pol and the continuity of her Pinar syndrome, and explaining that from fusion and stigma and kind of, you know, cleaning that up at the end of, you know, 4 years of developing the Vulcans to connect them to TOS. Again, I'm a broken record, but I love that continuity that Enterprise fed into TOS.
It was good that they did address Pinar syndrome and wrap that up. And interesting that they gave an explanation for it. And we already knew that from Stigma, especially, that the information being given to the public by the Vulcan government about what Pinar syndrome is was not accurate, because they, you know, they wanted to discourage people from mind melding. But here the explanation that it's caused by melders who have been improperly trained, which is what T'Pau tells T'Pol. And then, I don't know, I was trying to imagine, what does that mean though? Like, you put your fingers in the wrong place, you poke the wrong point. I don't know, create some kind of like chemical imbalance or something in the brain, I guess, because she says that one with great experience can correct the neurological imbalance.
It's a complicated thing, man. You got to get the rhythm right. You got to make sure the mood is okay. And, you know, everybody's got to be on the same page.
Exactly.
But, you can't.
And when you put your fingers on the side of the face, you can't get a nostril.
That's
you can't
right.
Get
you don't
want to,
yeah, it's, you got eyeball problems. There's a lot of obstacles on this face here.
Yeah. Poke someone in the eye.
You can't just grab a Horta and expect to communicate.
No.
Absolutely not.
But they did conveniently forget her Trillium D addiction, though, when they corrected her brains.
Yeah, that's true. It's a good thing that Spock was properly trained. Otherwise, that Horta could have contracted Pinar syndrome.
Well, to be fair, all he could get out of him was no kill eye. I mean,
it's true.
That's right. Even mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, in fairness to Spock, he was trying to find a nostril and an ear hole.
You know? Right.
Well, okay, you mentioned the Cotrus there, James. And when we did The Forge, we actually ended up naming that episode of The Ready Room Excessive Use of Cotrus. And the reason is that, and I mean, it doesn't bother me in terms of the plot device here. I just always notice that it seems that key humans often end up with the Cotrus of key Vulcans in their heads. You know, you've got Spock and McCoy. You've got the mind meld with Picard and Sarek. Here you've got Archer carrying the Katra of the father of Vulcan philosophy. And it just seems like so convenient that these critical human Starfleet officers keep ending up with Katras in their heads.
That's called continuity, man. Listen, I think I said this last time when we recorded. I said 700 plus hours of Star Trek, you're going to get a few of those. That's really not that many. That's three. And they're pretty disparate uses. And yeah. And I think it's awesome. Well, what can I say? I love that kind of...
I know a lot of people on Twitter who would like to have Solar's Katra in their head.
You know, we never got to see what it looked like from McCoy's point of view, to have Spock's Katra within it rattling around in his brain. And I think, you know, for whatever imperfections were there in this, it was at least cool to see from Archer's point of view, of all people, by the way, Archer having a Vulcan philosopher, you know, sharing brain space with him and kind of interrupting his day with inspirational screensavers. Like, you know, it's fascinating though to see. And I thought it was executed pretty well, because you could see the pain on Surak's face, and, you know, and watching his civilization destroy itself. But you could also see this kind of awareness that he's communicating with the future. And you get into this mystical place that we play with the Vulcans sometimes, and in a very different way than with the Bajorans or anybody else. And it's like, I don't know how to perceive this, but it's pretty weird and it's pretty cool to watch the one guy who shouldn't be dealing with this deal with it. There were shades of Sisko and the Prophets, I thought, in that kind of this guy, you know?
The interesting twist with that as well is the logical Vulcans that come out of these owe their existence to an emotional human.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and not only an emotional human, but I think your point, Michael, is really good that so when McCoy ends up with Spock's Katra, McCoy is very accustomed to Vulcans. You know, he's been a shipmate of Spock for all this time. And so McCoy liked to jab Spock, of course, but they were like brothers. So they're very, very close. And also, if you look at Picard, you know, mind melding with Sarek, of course, Picard is completely like it's a normal thing for him. You know, he respects Vulcans. He certainly respects Sarek. That's great. But Archer, you know, starting out this series, just hating the Vulcans, just blaming them for holding back mankind. And all this headbutting with the Vulcans throughout the series, even up to this point, yes, for him to end up with Sarek's Katra in his head, it was really a very, very different situation and a very different feel and really far more interesting, I think, as well, from a storytelling point of view.
They play it so well through all three episodes where he's starting to pick up on these little... He's not drinking water in the forge because he thinks he doesn't need it because he's Vulcan. And I will never get tired of at the end of Kirshara when he gives a Vulcan neck pinch to one of those guards they're fighting T'Pau's standing over him and says, "Your technique has improved." That kind of payoff makes the whole story worth it.
When that moment happened, my roommate who was watching the show with me was like, "Wait, what? Just because he's carrying around the Katra, he can do Vulcan neck pinches now?" I'm like, "Well, you know, he's got Surak's Katra in there." Okay. And he's like, "Well, McCoy couldn't do it in Star Trek 3." And I was like, "You really paid attention to Star Trek there. That was pretty cool. All right, yeah, good point. But it wasn't. It was just Spock. It wasn't Surak in there. So you could still justify that away, right?"
Yeah, you're talking about the man who invented this.
That's exactly right. Yeah,
yeah.
Did you see how he was handling that Lerpa? I mean, come on, fantastic.
Yeah. All he needed was the Amok time music and it being well alive.
That's right. Great.
And before we get too far away from that, James, I do want to say that I agree. I think Scott Bakula, it's always nice to see him get the opportunity to break away from the shipboard Archer, who's kind of inflexible and grating and annoying in his roughness sometimes, where it's just like, "No, I'm inflexible and I'm very tense and I'm not very fun to be around," probably, to this kind of serene desert wandering half Surak kind of thing. It was such a relief. It was so nice to get a dose of alternate Archer, if you will.
Of all the impressions ever done on this show, Michael, I think that your Archer might be the best.
Oh, God, no.
Well, in that vein, let me just mention quickly too that I thought that the actress who they cast for T'Pau is amazing. I mean, she hasn't been in a lot. Kara Zediker. I just love her portrayal. I love her look. I love the outfits they had her in. And I know she hasn't done a lot, but I'm surprised because she was really, really good in this role. Not an easy role to play either.
Not at all easy. I was reading some notes on Memory Alpha. Apparently, she was taking inspiration for her performance from T'Pau, like from what she remembered of the original series episode, and that was before they even told her who she was playing. Yeah.
Oh, that's wow! I didn't even know that.
But you can see that there are moments where her demeanor and her delivery, you can totally buy that this is the same character, the same woman, but she's young here. The moments in the voice, it was just really spot on.
Yeah. It's a nice twist as well, because the original concept when I was doing Enterprise was T'Pol would be T'Pau.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Oh.
That's a great point, Colin.
I'm glad they didn't go that way, though.
Yeah, yeah, immensely.
Yeah.
I think this was such a great payoff for that. But that's a great point, Colin, that I forgot that there's a little bit of synergy between the two, and T'Pau and T'Pol was going to be T'Pau at the very beginning. That's a great point.
I often forget that.
It's also nice to see that over, you know, the thousands and thousands of years of Vulcan's existence, they haven't run out of T names.
I was just thinking right now, as James, as you were trying to say to Pal and to Paul, and I have been as well, I was just picturing like a Vulcan classroom where the teacher's calling roll, and there are all of these names that are to put over and over. Gosh, yeah. Poor teacher.
Yeah, that's one to thank Gene Roddenberry for. Vulcan names have to bring with tea and Klingons with a K.
Yeah.
Of course, she was married to a Koss.
Oh, well. Maybe you had a Klingon grandfather.
There you go.
Well, let's use this as a point to move away from the Khatris here for a minute and talk about a Vulcan that didn't have to at the beginning of their name, and that's Velas, the crazy, maniacal leader of the High Command who is planning an invasion of a foreign land and hiding the real information from the rest of the High Command.
A passionate Vulcan, as McCoy would say.
Yeah. You know, subtlety is not something Star Trek's always known for, right?
Sometimes they can be very subtle. In this case, it was very direct. Yeah. I mean, the timing of this episode, it aired in November of 2004. So the timing of that airing and production schedule with the WMD search is pretty pretty connected.
There's that one exchange where they're talking in the High Council chamber. They're talking about the data they have on the Andorians having stolen the Zindi weapon.
Yeah.
It's like, but we have the data. Yeah. We've seen it. And then, you know, it's like, but data can be manufactured. And it's like, what? Just say yellow cake, guys. You just want just say uranium, and we will get it. I promise. Yeah. But you know what?
All you wanted was someone to turn around and say, "Have you not heard of Photoshop?"
I was thinking about this recently because I saw Elysium recently, and I, despite the criticism that film has got, I actually
no spoilers.
I actually enjoyed it, but it too is not subtle in its treatment of social issues, and I think it's because of my long exposure to Star Trek that I really really don't mind that at all, and so you can kind of give the show a pass on this because at least it is tackling those issues, right? I mean, are we in agreement there, or should it?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
No,
yeah.
That's what Star Trek's always done. It's always reflected social issues. That's what it does.
Well, that's what good real science fiction does in general. You know, if you go to science fiction literature, that's the basis of science fiction. And yeah, no, I have no problem with it. It was kind of interesting. But it's so out there. It's so completely that Vulcan is the U.S. and Andoria is Iraq. And the Zindi technology is the WMD search. And that's and everyone's right. Planning an invasion. It's
yeah. But the reality is out of newspaper. That's no different.
The Chinese must have been watching this thinking, see, I told you it wasn't us. The Romulans are not Chinese. I told you.
Yeah, that throws home.
But the reality is again, through the 700 plus hours, there's a lot of direct analogies. I mean, Private Little War is, you know, right in the middle of the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a pretty pretty direct analogy that, you know, who knows if people were sitting around their TVs going, wait a second, this is obvious. I doubt they were, 50 years ago. And I'll hazard a guess that there's plenty of Americans out there, no idea what they were referring to. None whatsoever. Probably. So I'm just going to go on record and say that I think that's probably a safe bet.
Oh, next thing you'll be saying is that people who watch Metropolis didn't realize it was about robots.
Wait, what was interesting...
By the way, Michael. Yeah. Elysium, what was up with Jodie Foster? Her accent. I mean, one of the funniest things I've seen in a movie, unintentionally, in a long time. Sorry, I digress.
You are so right. Yes. You are so right. I'm going to restrain myself from answering because we'll go for 25 minutes. Okay. But you are absolutely correct. I was LOLing, yep. And it wasn't supposed to be happening. Yes, we should talk after the air. I think that Vlas. This was interesting outside of the social commentary aspect, but Vlas is a demonstration of how hypocritical these early Vulcans can be, because he kind of demonstrates exactly how duplicitous and just underhanded these pre-revolution Vulcans are. And you start to understand why Archer and people like him have such a problem with them, right? So this is a side effect of Floss's overly aggressive nature, you know?
Well, Archer says the Vulcans can lie with the best of them, referring to the High Command, and he's very right about that.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that was different in terms of, you know, the parallels between the search for the WMDs in Iraq and what's going on here is that the Vulcan High Command apparently has set up shop in a hotel in Las Vegas, because did you guys check out the carpet in that place?
Yes.
Actually, hey, before you go there, one quick side story, and I remember this from the set very clearly. They were trying to, it was one of the very first scenes where Trip had to be addressing Velas, and they were asking, okay, what's it, how do you say this guy's name? What's, you know, how do you pronounce his name? And the script coordinator said, all right, his name, it's like you're saying Velas Vegas. So that's the guy's name. And I always remember that in the back of my head, that I thought that was pretty funny. And that's a great segue to that wonderful set that did look a lot like a welcome area in Vegas casino.
I lived in Reno for a number of years, and downtown, you know, we have all the casinos and such, just like Las Vegas. And for our, like the American Marketing Association, American Advertising Federation, all, we would have our meetings and luncheons and special events in these casinos, in the ballroom areas and all. And the carpet here in Kearsarge, the carpet in the High Command, it looks, and just the general decor of the hallways and all, yeah, looks like casinos in Nevada.
Yeah.
Probably fair.
I'm really going to look forward to going to Star Trek Las Vegas now. I'm going to be checking the carpet tape.
Yeah, there was, we got an opportunity to see a couple interior design schemes, right? We got to see what a Federation, or what an Earth embassy looks like on Vulcan, which is, you know, pretty cool. We got some cheap looking columns there, but otherwise it's all right. And then the Vulcan High Command Center is, I didn't look at the carpet so much, but I kind of couldn't think of a better way they could have laid it out. Like, it looked a lot, it reminded me a bit of the Cardassian command centers from DS9, just in maybe in layout and stuff during the Dominion War arcs and stuff. But you have a lot of this rich wood, this warm lighting. You know, I fully believed it as an early Vulcan sort of command chamber, you know.
Did you not think it was a bit warm and welcoming for Vulcan, though?
Oh, that's a solid point. Yeah, it did look a lot, a very colorful. Comfortable. Yeah, and I don't know if I would be, if it would be necessarily that homey. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I think it was in line with other Vulcan interiors that we had seen through Enterprise up to that point. I think back even like in Stigma, when they go down and they have the doctor's facilities, they're having that conference. That felt kind of like this too. They seem to really play up the ornate nature, like the very colorful and ornate nature of Vulcan costume and interior design in Enterprise, which contrasts with what we see sometimes, which is the very dusty, you know, out, that kind of the desert feel that we've seen. But I don't know. I guess it just depends.
Not downstairs in the monastery on Pajem.
Yeah, yeah. So there are some differences there, but it didn't feel unusual to me. I think it felt Vulcan, especially the way they had built up the Vulcans to this point on Enterprise. I just found the carpet to be kind of funny because it reminded me so much of a casino. I was actually wondering, like, did they build this set, or did they actually just go out and shoot this at the Hilton or something?
Just set a monitor up on that wall and we'll shoot it from this angle. It'll be fine.
So what did you guys think about the struggles within the High Command, though? Again, as we talk about Vulcans, you know, Velas is so determined that he's going to invade Andoria. It's like he really wants a war, it seems. And you've got others on the High Command who want to be more cautious And we even see that too, not that Trip wants a war, but I liked the fact that on Enterprise itself, that you've got contrasting opinions between Trip and Malcolm. You know, where Malcolm thinks they should stay out of it, and Trip thinks, well, we have to get involved. Of course, Trip wants to avoid a war, but he feels like they have to charge in. So there's a lot of tug of war going here. But in terms of the High Council itself, I mean, how did you guys feel about that? As it's almost like the end of an era for the Vulcans, because after this, you know, the Serenites prevail and Sarek's philosophy begins to take hold again.
For last for me was a bit gung-ho.
Yeah.
It was like, I want my glory, I want my day in history type of feel to it. I mean, before we got to the end and you had the little twist that we get at the end, whereas you're watching it at this point when he's giving, we will attack, even when the plan's uncovered and the Andorians, and they know the Andorians are coming out to meet him, he still wants his day of glory. He still wants his battle. And the fact that the other Vulcans are logically arguing the point that he dismisses just goes to show that he has no control over his emotions and his thought process, which from a Vulcan point of view, you would think that would think, you know, this is totally irrational. This is very emotional. This is a very unbalanced line of thinking. You know, why are we listening to this guy from the Vulcan point of view? And I also think, going to what you said about Reed and Trip on the Enterprise, this is probably one of the few occasions where Reed does not want to blow something up.
That's right.
Such a good point. I love the interaction between those two guys as they're approaching Andorian space and the back and forth, and with you know, Reed questioning that Trip is, you know, taking counsel from Sovol. I just thought that was a great layer for this episode. And in terms of Velas, you know, that's that Romulan influence, right? Which they pay off at the very end of the episode. But of course, we never get to see played out later in any other Enterprise episodes, because that was near the end.
So yeah, we see, I want to talk a little bit more about that Romulan influence at the end here. But apart from that, it seems that it's almost easy through part of this, especially here in Kirshara, where the actual invasion is being prepared to take place, to feel like Velas, even though the other Vulcans are not as gung-ho about just jumping in and attacking, and certainly not attacking the Enterprise itself, like Velas is, you do get the feeling that overall the High Command is more open to the idea of invading Andoria, that they really have taken kind of the, I don't know, the Vulcans from the beginning of Broken Bow, they all tend to be kind of like asses, right? And it's like they've taken that to an extreme here in the High Command. But then it does end up being where it seems that Velas really is sort of an outlier, and he's just really crazy, while the rest of the Vulcans in the High Command, while not the Vulcans that we would normally think of from later on in Star Trek, are a lot more tempered in their approach, and they at least want to know that what they're doing has some sort of justification before they actually do it.
Yeah, we get seeds, you know, early on in the episode that Velas's fellow board members are not really all in on this, and they're not really hip to this this aggressive stance. So, you know, I do wish that we had gotten a more three-dimensional Velas, because normally, well, sometimes Star Trek villains are much more fleshed out, and we can understand the reasons they do things, even if we don't agree with them. But in this case, I mean, yeah, this is maybe what contributed to making that Rumsfeld allegory not as subtle as it could have been, because there was almost no sympathizing with Velas. It's just like, okay, you're not even making a compelling argument that, like, this is for the security of Vulcan. It's like, no, you're just kind of want to exterminate people, and you're giving lip service to this threat. You know, I don't know. That part of the episode sort of fell flat to me. We knew that his assistant was going to get him.
Yeah, because not only the invasion of Andorian, but just trying to annihilate the Cyrenites. And, you know, he tells them that comb the desert, make sure there are no survivors. And I have to say, too, are you guys with me? Every time I hear someone say comb the desert, I see that scene from Spaceballs where they have the giant combs. Are you guys the same? So I was picturing them with like they're combs, but they look kind of like Lerpas, and you have Vulcans out there actually literally combing the desert.
Just as long as they're not metal combs.
Right.
I always felt like Velos, they would have brought him back and they would have played him out a little bit more depth to show that Romulan connection, because you don't know about the Romulan connection when you're watching him be kind of a flat one-note character.
Exactly.
Right.
So at the end, when that pays off a little bit, it's like, oh, there is something deeper here behind the unification, whatever he's trying to accomplish there as it relates to annihilating Andoria.
Well, the bit at the end where it's revealed that he's basically a Romulan operative, that gives you two leads into two other series each. You get the reunification, which is TNG, and it's also the introduction of the Romulans into the Enterprise canon. But from a human point of view, we don't see Romulans from humans till Balance of Terror. Mm-hmm. So you've got that two angles. You know, they hint at reunification, which is a TNG show, and you know, but all the time this is going to be going on in the background. And even when Romulans pop up in later Enterprises, you don't see the Romulans.
Right.
You see what the Romulans create and what the Romulans build, but you don't see Romulans from the human perspective.
Which is a shame, because I was looking forward to the episode of Enterprise discussing how the Romulan head ridges came about. Because, you know, we had the Klingon one. So.
Yeah.
They downloaded the
cosmetic surgery.
Yeah. Obsession with plastic surgery. I like that.
Yeah. You know, anyone who's seen the Kardashians will know how that happens. Yeah.
Maybe Romulus is a lot like South Korea. They're just really, really obsessed with plastic surgery.
I was just going to say, Chris, do they still do the donut head thing in certain parts of closer to you? You know what I'm talking about? The water droplet skin inflammation thing? I'll have to send you a link.
That's a perfect example, Michael. Excellent.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that still goes on, but yes, there are things like that, of course, in our own history.
Yeah.
And on cultures here on Earth, which, you know, could be. I mean, of course, the real answer is we needed to be able to tell the difference between Vulcans and Romulans on screen. So right. Let's give them a different forehead. But
oh, come on. I mean, this is a race of people that can't tell Superman's Clark Kent from a pair of glasses.
True. Speaking of which, in terms of those Romulans, I love, again, just a little throwaway reference to when I can't remember the character's name, but he's talking to T'Pol and he says, I served with you in Tomed, which, of course, the Tomed incident was what they referenced in the neutral zone when the Romulans came back after 50 years. And I remember the first time I heard that, I was like, Tomed, I know that. And I remember looking it up, and I love that connection. Now, they're not the same.
Yeah, that's a nice event, little thing to drop in there.
But that's Mike Sussman, who's the writer of this episode. He's such
and he
a
kept the tea.
Trekkie. Yeah. I know that a guy like him would go and pull that kind of thing and drop it in there for the geeks like me to go, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. I like those little obscure things like that really, really diehard fans will pick up on. If one issue with Enterprise Season 4, and you know, a lot of Star Trek fans always say that Enterprise Season 4, that was the best season. Because I think that the storylines that we got in Season 4, like this one here, are the things that people really, really wanted to see, as opposed to what we got earlier on. But there's a danger in that, and they sometimes slip into it, of fanboying too much on screen, where it's just like, you can tell you know, that Manny Coto and Mike Sussman and Judith and Garfield here, that they all really love this material from TOS and they know it very well. And sometimes you can slip into moments where the story just feels like too much of a fanboy moment. Like you want more of like a realistic progression towards that. But in this trilogy here, I think they do a really nice job of using T'Pol, you know, using incidents like this and referencing, you know, bringing the Romulans in at the very end without making it feel too much like that. So this one feels like a nice balance.
There is one thing we haven't mentioned, which we should, is the torture scene.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Which, again, is, you know, Sussman and Meld in Voyager. And the fact that the Andorians came up with a device that can punish the Romulans with emotions is bad enough. But it also reminded me of Garak torturing Odo.
Oh, yeah.
Where Garak didn't really want to torture Odo, but he felt he had to. And I'll get that with Tram. I think Tram didn't want to torture him, but he felt he had to. And I thought that was an interesting balance between, like, you know, I have to do this for my people, whereas, and that's how Garak justified it. He had to do it, you know. And Star Trek has had torture scenes in most of its incarnations. You know, I mean, Picard was tortured by the Cardassians. Kirk was tortured. You know, it's in all the incarnations, and I think they handled it very, very well in this. It wasn't glorified. It wasn't for the sake of it. It served the plot purpose.
Right.
I think that's a good point, Colin. What I like about it, too, is the consistency with Shran's character. And they were always on the cusp for literally four seasons with Shran of, okay, maybe he's an ally. He was never truly an ally. He never went all the way to the point where he was trustworthy or going to be their buddy. I mean, I love the, and again, in this, there's a not a throwaway line, but when he says in the middle of the battle, "Tell Archer that's two he owes me."
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just another great connection through the series. And again, gives a lot of consistency to a character that never goes all the way to being your buddy. It's similar to Garak. Similar.
It's a pretty good Jeffrey Combs impression you got there, James.
Yeah, it's almost as good as your Archer impression.
As I understand it from Manny Koto's Magic Bag of Hindsight, Shran was going to become a series regular in the fifth season. And I guess actually was he going to be on the Enterprise, Colin?
Yes.
That's what
he was
going
to be. He's going to be in a similar role to T'Pol, but for the Andorians.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That would have been awesome to see. Jeffrey Combs as a series regular, would have been really...
And the concept was that... Shram and T'Pol would constantly bang heads.
Sure.
That would have been one of the greatest things ever if they had been able to get that season 5.
Yeah.
But alas, yeah. It didn't happen.
Ah, the Romulan War.
It would have also been a nice bridge towards bringing together the Federation, because one thing I like in the new novel that's out by Christopher L. Bennett, The Rise of the Federation, A Choice of Futures, is they actually really delve into the humans and the Andorians and the Vulcans and the Tellarites as well, working together and bringing their technology together and their crews and their uniform design and trying to make all that mesh, and bringing Shran onto the show and having him on the ship would have been a first step. And then maybe, you know, in season 6 and 7, maybe we would have seen more mixing of the Andorians, humans, and Vulcans as well. It would have been a nice bridge and serving that purpose as a prequel.
It would have been nice to see Shram training the Makos as well.
Oh,
and doing fighting techniques.
Yeah.
That's right.
That would have been amazing.
Then the Makos could all open up some Andorian fight scenes on everyone.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
Yeah. That would have been wicked.
So
just go for the antler.
Before we get off of the Romulan twist, and as we kind of get near the end here of the discussion, it was such, I don't know. I mean, I thought it was interesting, but I don't know if it actually worked for the story, because it was so much at the very, very end, out of the shadows, comes the Romulan. And then we know it's never going to go anywhere. And I don't know if, for me, I don't know if it really worked. Like, as you guys talk about, after that scene, when you look back it's an explanation for all of Velas's actions. Like, I think that's a valid point, and I can see that. But at the same time, I mean, I would like to know more about why that is. You know, okay, so I guess he's a Romulan operative. He's infiltrated. The Romulans have infiltrated the high command at the highest level. But of course, they're doing it all out of reunification of their people. I mean, now how does destroying Andoria, what does that have to do with the reunification of Romulus and Vulcan? And what would you have wanted to see if that storyline had continued?
Well, for him to be in the highest level of command and be a Romulan operative, that mean he would have had to have been deep cover for decades, for starters. So it would have been nice to see, because it would have involved a network of people. It wouldn't have just been him. So I think what they could have done is they could have explored the exposure of that network. That's one way they could have gone. But from the point of view of Vulcans attacking Andorians and trying to instigate a war between them, the only thing I can see that Romulus would have gained from that is that this time in the timeline, the Federation isn't the Federation. Earth's not really a threat. So the two biggest powers in the quadrants opposed to Romulus would have been the Andorians and the Vulcans. So it would have been a similar philosophy that they implied in the movies, whereby you take out the big boy and then the other ones are easy to pick off.
Okay.
It's a good question. I've never thought about it. Other than every time I'm watching that episode and it comes to an end, I'm always a little bit disappointed. Like, oh, yeah, that's there. And it's just sitting there because it's never going to be addressed. So I have no idea what I would have wanted to see, but I feel like they would have paid that off in a really strong way in season 5 based on these 3 episodes and based on the 3 Romulan episodes that come up, you know, a little bit after this.
Right, because this cultural awakening and revolution that the finding of the Kirshara instigated would have taken forever. So you would have had a lot of these sort of primitive Vulcans that we've come to know in Enterprise, these duplicitous, you know, lying, not very nice Vulcans, engaging in kind of political intrigue and outright combat with the very sneaky, very mean, very angry Romulans. And I think that whole thing would have been really, really cool to see. Of course, it's a shame we didn't get to see it, but I love this note in the Memory Alpha article on the episode that scene at the end almost didn't make it to the screen for budgetary reasons, so that they had to reuse a Romulan uniform from Nemesis, and if this scene was very nearly cut because there was no money left in the budget even to pay for another speaking role. So the scene was adjusted so that the Romulan was Talok, and that's wild to me. My roommate injected a little bit more commentary into the episode at that point. He's like, "Man, can't the Vulcans ever just be bad on their own? Why do they have to have a Romulan come in and you know, make them bad?" And I was like, "Well, you know, these are Enterprise Vulcans. You know, it's a little different, but it was funny though." But very interesting scene from both sides of the camera.
They like to play with other people.
Yeah, that's right. No sense being insular when you're this interesting. But yeah.
It would have been interesting also to see if they took that and spun it somehow as a cause of the Romulan War, or somehow that played in to what initiates the Romulan War between the humans and the Romulans. Kind of filling in a lot of details, because certainly I'm pretty sure we would have gotten the Romulan War in those final seasons, and maybe it was it would have been a good little setup anyway.
Yeah, I think
have you read the Romulan War books, Chris? Yeah.
I actually have not read those yet. I'm making my way towards them.
Have you, James?
Yeah, no, I have not either. I like Chris's point though. I think that would have been a great connection to make, but I guess you have, Colin. I've heard they're great.
I was just wondering, where's Matt Rushing when you want him?
I'm going on an adventure!
I have not read those yet, but they're on my list.
I was just wondering if that played out in the books, that's all.
Yeah. I mean, again, and to talk about the ending again, I think it's a great Enterprise summation when T'Pol, when T'Pau, I did it again, when T'Pau and Archer are walking out of the council chamber, and she says, "Hey, it's time for Earth to stand on its own 2 feet." And he just says, "We're ready." I mean, again, such a great 4-year payoff for literally the first couple of scenes of Enterprise and Broken Bow.
Yeah.
Now, if it had been Kirk saying that, he would have said, "You're on your own. I hope you're up to it." All right. Well, we've passed an hour in the discussion here, so why don't we wrap up with our final thoughts? And James, how about you?
All right. Well, yeah, I think from my end, again, I said it before, these are my favorite episodes of Enterprise. I think they're top-notch. The Forge is definitely my favorite standalone episode. And I think these three together, I would have to give them the full 10 Lerpas.
Excellent. Colin, how about you?
I love Enterprise, period. But I do like these because, as I said at the start, it gives us the Vulcans we come to know and love in later incarnations of Star Trek. I like the little twist that the Vulcans owe it to a human. I like that little twist to it. It's also, like you said, it could have been the setup for the Romulan War with the humans coming to the aid of the Vulcans, which would have been a nice little twist again. And it's got Jeffrey Combs in it. I mean, come on, the guy's everywhere.
He is everywhere.
You know, you can't have Star Trek without Jeffrey Combs popping up in some guise. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't know this, but we did Blood Oath the other week on Trek News and Views, and I was convinced that all them guards were Jeffrey Combs.
He could pull it off.
So, yeah. So I would give this, 10 Vulcan sand granules. Wow.
All right. How about you, Michael?
You know, I think Enterprise didn't get too many chances to do what the series initially set out to do, which was to build the future world that we were used to seeing and to let us see how that came to be. But this is one of those episodes where it was able to do that. And it did it in rather epic fashion in a 3-part arc. That was, for the most part, compelling, and which I enjoyed watching. I think it could have been condensed. I really think this could have been I know that there was only one legitimate 2-parter in this 3-episode, but this is a 3-episode arc. So it would have been nice to distill this a little bit, but we had a nice payoff. We got a nice mix of action and world building. We got some nice performances, and it was a fun romp that also paid off a little bit in terms of the greater lore of Star Trek. So I would give this one a good 7.5 human Vulcan nerve pinches of unknown origin.
Very good. Yeah, as I said at the very beginning, I think that this trilogy is some of the best Star Trek from the whole franchise. And it's not at the very top of my list, but it's really great storytelling, and it fills in a very important time in the history of Vulcan civilization, and it explains a lot about how the Vulcans and humans come together, their relationship, as you guys pointed out today, really great point about the Vulcans owing their logical future to a human who actually hated them, and that's great, and I'm disappointed that there are lost opportunities. We've just talked about the Romulan twist. Also, you know, we find out at the end of this that the High Council, I keep calling it High Council, whatever, it's Vulcan, is being dissolved. And so what does that mean? You know, what happens in Vulcan civilization and Vulcan government with that, or that group being dissolved? I would have liked to have known more about that. So I think that this represents both what's great about Star Trek and great about Enterprise, and also it encompasses the lost promise and opportunity of Enterprise as well. So it's kind of it's a great story that's kind of bittersweet as well. But I love it, and I say anyone who says that they don't like Enterprise, they need to go and watch the story, watch these 3 episodes, and turn the sound down during the opening credits if the song is an issue for you, and watch this story, because you cannot watch this story as a Star Trek fan and then say you don't like Enterprise. I really think that if you watch this, you'll want to go and watch this series. And so I'm going to give this story 10 Gallicite deposits. Just
can't
steer
believe
clear.
We didn't talk about those. Yeah.
Just steer clear of my rating if you have any metal objects on your person.
That's right.
All right. Well, James, before we go, tell everyone where they can find you around the internets.
I am available on Twitter and Twitter only at Enterprise Extra, where I do nothing but talk about Star Trek.
Imagine that. All right. Twitter only. Very good. And Colin, where can people find the Supreme Commander of Europe?
You can find me on Twitter and Google Plus at COLMH01. So me and the other 10 people on Google Plus will say hello to you. And you can find me on Trek News and Views, which is on the Trek FM network, which is available on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Trek Radio, and a host of other places. And if you want to follow the Trek News and Views podcast accounts, it's Trek News Views on Twitter.
Very good. Well, thanks a lot for joining us today, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Great time, guys. Thank you. That was awesome. I never really know who's going to be in on the feature until I actually arrive, because I'm not all that great at preparation. But man, that was a lot of fun. It was great to chat with those guys on this very intense season arc, wasn't it? I mean, story arc of these three episodes.
It really was. Yeah, I had a lot of fun too. And, you know, we did The Forge about, I don't know, a year or so ago. So it was fun to return to this. And I'm sure if we listened to those episodes back to back, we probably rehashed some content, but, you know, I saw different things in the trilogy watching it this time as well. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and different personalities on the air, taking different stuff from the thing. You know, that's the nice part about it. You change your perspective and the episode's content magically changes as well.
Well, you know, Michael, this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at some other things that you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
The Maquis.
But then he tells Eddington, I'm going to do this to all the other Maquis planets as well. And it's, you don't F with the Sisko, is basically what we get to here.
Do not frack with the Sisko.
Exactly.
The Ready Room.
The Q and the Gray.
Well, there's kind of two sides to his guide to romance, though, because while we do see his futile attempts with Catherine Janeway, there's also the interaction he has with the female Q, which I found be much more interesting.
Deck 8.
STO Foundry, Alpha Flight.
It's quite light. The main thing is you get to fly around, test your flying skills, and test your ability to withstand combat.
I think we failed in that sort of
thing. But let's just ignore that.
To the journey!
Life on Voyager.
Well, I'm just saying, there was a certain, you know, there was a time period when the Doctor was, you know, like a Ken doll. So that's all I'm saying.
I would not be a Ken doll. Let's put it that way.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Hell House.
And I think that this book largely is about how sexual indulgences can get lumped in together with a lot of other forms of transgression, moral and ethical and personal.
Warp 5.
T-Paul.
Certainly she'd always had a dry humour all of the way through. We saw that more probably from season 2 onwards. And if we think about the sensuality and the feline movements from, as well as she's described it, then I don't think we really saw that until she started to explore her emotions more.
Trek News and Views.
Blood Oath and Michael and Sarah.
Obviously it has Dax in it, so win. But the one thing that DS9 has done for me has it's given me a greater appreciation of Klingons.
Literary Treks.
Nero Comics.
This place feels terrible and horrible, and such a good job, I think, by the artist to really create a sense of a menace into this place. Like, you don't want to be at Rurapente. It really does feel like the aliens' graveyard.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all these shows. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week. Some days we even have two shows, and you'll find them everywhere you get your podcasts, in iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, even Zune. You can stream from the website. You can download files from the website. Go check them all out and go to trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. Now, Michael, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they'd like to share their thoughts on Kurshara, on the Serenite trilogy, or anything else that we talked about in news today. Maybe they want to ask 1/8 Beverly out on a date. They can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to us by email. If you'd like to join in a discussion with other listeners, you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums. And in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And we're always tweeting away about Star Trek every day on Twitter under username TrekFM. Now, Michael, what if people want to find you? Maybe they have some questions about Star Trek, or maybe they want to ask you which smartphone they should buy. Where should they go?
Those would be valid questions all the way around, and I don't always guarantee a proper response, but I usually guarantee a response. People can find me on Twitter, where I am most active, talking about those things and some other weirder ones, at Captain2Phones. That's Captain, the number 2, Phones. And please be warned that I sometimes tweet weird stuff, but usually it's a lot of fun. So please join me there. It's great times. I should also mention I am also the host of the Pocket Now Weekly podcast. So if you're into mobile technology and you want to listen to my voice some more for whatever reason, you can join me over there at pocketnow.com.
Excellent. And of course, we also covered some of the new technology coming in the next version of the iPhone during the feature today. So I'll be looking for your video and article on that over
in Pocket.
That's right.
And hopefully my power won't go out in the middle of telling you about it as it did tonight.
That's right. Well, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username. And you'll find my personal website at cbrianjones.com, where, believe it or not, I do talk about things other than Star Trek. So you can check that out if you're interested. And elsewhere on the network, you'll find me every Sunday with Matthew Rushing on Literary Treks, where we talk about Star Trek books and comics. On Monday, Matthew and I talk about Deep Space Nine on The Orb. And on Fridays, I'm with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk about Enterprise, as we did today, but we do it every week. So check that out if you are an Enterprise fan. And lastly, before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsors for this week's show. Your support of our sponsors is very important to making it possible for us to bring the Ready Room to you every week. First, there's Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, online store, really anything you can imagine. Create your own space today. I promise you're going to love it. Go to squarespace.com for your free 14-day trial and then use offer code TREK8 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM and the Ready Room. Also, please visit TrekFan.org. Now, TrekFan is not just a Star Trek fan club. It's an amazing chance for you to come together with the fans to do more than just talk about Star Trek. Of course, we all love to talk about Star Trek, but here you'll be collaborating to solve puzzles and complete real-life mission objectives. And you can turn your love for Star Trek into something that can help us all move toward that Star Trek future. So support us and support TrekFan by visiting TrekFan.org. Solve that first puzzle. Take the next step on your adventure, and we really thank TrekFan for their support of Trek FM and our programming. And lastly, if you would personally like to support the network and our programming, we have a great way for you to do that as well. We have 8 new alien-themed badges as a thank you for your contributions that are perfect for your shirt, for your bag, for your dress uniform, or for your special white outfit as you cross the Desert Forge on Vulcan. There are 44mm badges with original illustration by Toba Ushi, who does most of the art that you see on our website. And we also have art prints that you can choose as well, which have larger, beautiful A5 size views of the aliens. You can mix and match. There are different donation levels for you to choose from. And you'll find it all at trek.fm/donate. So please visit, make a contribution. Your donations help us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring this programming to you every week. And we really appreciate your support of Trek FM. Well, Michael, that's another show. You know, I'm going to wander off right now. I've got this new game I've come up with. I'm going to go down to the caves, and I'm going to play chicken with the Gallicite deposits.
Well, Chris, good luck with that. And I think it's time to stick a Katra in it, because the Ready Room is done.